Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Okay, this is Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. I'm the host, Brady Huggett, and our guest for this episode is Carl Feldbaum. Carl was the founding president of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, otherwise known as BIO. He joined in 1993, and he was the head of it until 2005 when he stepped away. We talked about that on this podcast. We also talked about his life before BIO, which was equally as interesting. He was an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia focused on corruption. He helped prosecute the Watergate scandal. He told me a great story about meeting Saddam Hussein, which not many people can say that, or at least not many people that I know can say that. Right, so this is a little long for us. It's a little over an hour. I was looking for ways to maybe trim it back, but I had trouble. Almost everything in the conversation seemed of interest to me, and I hope it's of interest to you. So I will have more to say on the backside of this, but for now, here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Carl Feldbaum. Okay. So yeah, you flew in. You said you flew in.
Yeah, flew in, and rainy Saturday, and at my hotel, and just get used to a little time difference, and walk around the streets a bit.
Yeah, and how long are you gonna be?
I'm gonna be here till Wednesday, then I fly to Boston for another board meeting.
Which company is that?
Exelixis, San Francisco.
Yeah, I know them.
So they meet once or twice a year in Boston.
And so you still sit on those boards?
I do, and I'm chair of Life Sciences Foundation,
right.
And I'm on the board of BioVentures for Global Health.
Oh yeah, I forgot.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, busy.
Let's.
I've flunked retirement.
You did
several
yeah.
times.
I do remember when you left Bio. You know, people are like, well, what are you going to do? And you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to Idaho and think about it for a while. And
exactly.
It's like you thought you were out, and they pulled you back in.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
Thought about it. Someone told me the first thing I should do is sit down and read War and Peace, which I did.
Yeah.
And then by the time I was through with that, I was thinking about what to do next. And it was winter in Idaho and very cold. And
right.
I had a couple of some longstanding invitations to join boards, which I could not do while I was at Bio.
Yeah.
And since we represented the whole industry, and then I decided to jump back in. And I...
Oh, is that in the is that in the bylaws of running Bio? You cannot sit on boards.
Yeah, it was one of the things we made up. I mean, we made up the whole sort of the constitution of the organization.
Right.
And you could not invest in a single company if you were an employee.
Makes sense.
Nor could you, join a board. You had to represent the whole industry and not
your
special
personal
interest in one company.
But you did not grow up in Idaho. No, I think you...
I like to say I grew up in the West. I grew up in West Philadelphia. And I grew up there and went to high school there and intended to become a physician.
Oh, really?
Yeah, through high school as a science major. And then I majored in biology in college.
In Princeton?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that. But so why were you in Philadelphia? Was your family from there?
Yeah, my family came from directly from Belarus and the Ukraine to Philadelphia for some reason. And my grandparents.
Right.
And my parents and grandparents had a produce business, fruits and vegetables, and which we were dissuaded. I'm one of four boys, and we were dissuaded from going into the family business. So each of us had to find something else to do. And when asked as a kid, I was the oldest child and the oldest grandchild what I wanted to do when I grew up. I could never hit on something that satisfied them until I said I wanted to be a doctor.
And they said, that's the one.
That's the one. So I grew up and then thinking I was going to be a doctor, forgetting I just said it to be to get them off my back.
Right.
And then when I was in junior in college, I actually faced some decisions of medical school, law school, or Vietnam. And at the time, the woman I was dating, who later became my wife, her father was a very distinguished constitutional lawyer. And his dinner table stories about arguing cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and criminal law and constitutional law really got my attention. And I'd switched from an ambition from going to medical school, and I went to law school.
How'd your parents take that news?
That was okay, not as good as going to medical school, but
yeah.
That was my choice.
Right. You didn't, it's not like you told them you're going to become a street musician or something. Law school was still a career that...
Yeah, something they, you know, if I'd had my way, I would have become perhaps a marine biologist or
right.
something. No, law school. And then in law school, I got very involved in constitutional law and criminal law, and one of my professors was... Arlen Specter, who was then district attorney of Philadelphia, and he he taught a court. He was a fearsome professor, as well as district attorney, as well as senator later.
Right.
And I was in a 12-person seminar, Problems of Prosecution, and all of us were sort of cowering because he'd call on one of us and grill us. And I had to think, well, I could be in Vietnam.
And this is this could be worse.
This could be worse.
Yeah.
He later hired me, and I was an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia.
Right,
for a while.
I saw that. Yeah. So, your grandparents came from Belarus. I'm assuming for the manufacturing positions or something in Philly, right? I mean, that's these cities draw people.
No, they were essentially fleeing religious oppression, the Russian Empire and the Tsarist pogroms, in the very edge of the Western Russian Empire. And I think got to Hamburg and got on a boat and perhaps had a relative who landed in Philadelphia before them.
Pulled
and they were peddlers, started as peddlers with fruits and stuff you can carry on your back.
Right.
And then graduated to push carts. And then in my father's generation, he was the first to go to college and had sort of wider and broader ambitions.
So from the push cart, eventually they had their own storefront.
They were wholesalers. They became wholesalers. So they got carloads, railroad cars of fruits and vegetables from the South and the West, Texas, carrots, lettuce, citrus fruits, and sold them to grocery stores and supermarkets.
I see.
Yeah, my family migrated. I was born in South Philadelphia, actually, and we moved to West Philadelphia where I lived and then eventually out to the suburbs.
Before you had decided that you were going to go to medical school, you were studying biology because you liked it?
I was studying essentially biology. I did like biology. I did not care so much for chemistry. And I had noticed particularly during my Princeton University years, I was pretty inept in the laboratory and did not do that well with my experiments, burned my clothes, this sort of thing. Really inept, and it just—it was very clear that that was not a direction that would be good for me.
Right. So, do you think let's just pretend that you had pursued medical school and gone on. Do you think that you're a better fit for law than you were for being a physician?
Yeah, it turned out I'd probably unfit for either of them. I only ended up. I had an interesting law career, but it only lasted about 7 years.
Yeah. But you get out of Princeton with your biology degree. You make this decision, I'm actually going to switch and go to law school. You go to Penn for law school?
Yeah, I went to the University of Pennsylvania, my hometown law school.
Yep.
And that's where I met Specter and got pretty deeply interested. During the late 60s, early 70s, there was the Warren Supreme Court revolution in criminal law with defendants' rights. And it was a very interesting time to be involved in law. And as prosecutors, we had more discretion over how cases would be handled than defense counsel, and it was a good that was a good fit for me, and I did that for a couple of years.
And so this is when you're assistant DA, you're saying?
Yeah, I was in court just about every day.
And what kind of cases were you seeing?
Well, I was a junior DA, And at first, they, you know, assigned me to traffic court. So I'd get 20 files the night before and have to walk into a courtroom. The interesting part of that was not necessarily the running of stop signs or red lights, but it was the ability to organize a courtroom. I'd walk into the courtroom in the morning, and all these defendants and their lawyers and counsel were meandering around the courtroom. And my job was to, as soon as the judge came from behind the curtain and sat down, I had to have that
start
mess,
right in.
That mess organized. Say, you know, Your Honor, we're going to start with Ivan Cohen versus the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Ivan Cohen.
Huh, that's interesting. So it was sort of your job to run the courtroom for the prosecution all day long.
All day long. Huh. And it was, you know, it's part of the prosecution needs to make a case and
right.
prove a case. So you were in that position. And the organizational part of that was almost as interesting as the legal part. And I did what they call motions court, which were in serious cases like homicides or robberies or whatever. There would be motions to exclude evidence based on the fact that it was illegally obtained.
Mm-hmm.
And much of it was, actually. And so—
How so? You mean coerced—
Yeah,
coercive
confessions.
Yeah.
Philadelphia in those days during the, if I may say, the Frank Rizzo administration was not well known for the same kind of issues that unfortunately we're again experiencing today as they speak here in New York and
right.
Ferguson, Missouri, et cetera. So it's recycled or never stopped. But there was also a heroin epidemic in Philadelphia.
Again, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we just
right.
talked about this is happening now. Here.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So there were little flying bags of white powder all over, and sometimes the police story did not exactly match up.
I see. So in that period of time, I mean, what's one of the most interesting cases that you still remember today?
Well, what happened is I finally got out of when I mentioned the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Ivan Cohen. He was a high school classmate of mine.
Oh, really?
So occasionally I got to mishandle or let off one of my friends who'd run a red light or something. But the interesting part was—
I thought you'd need to recuse yourself from that.
Actually, in the better of all worlds, I should have.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Yeah.
It was an indiscretion for sure.
Ah. so we just got that on tape. Good. So you got your friend out of running a
yeah.
traffic stop.
Yeah. He was a professor, actually.
Oh.
I believe of mathematics. Sorry, Ivan. And sort of an absent-minded professor. And I tried to do my deal. I threatened him.
Yeah.
You know, and told him to pay attention. At our 50th high school reunion, I met him. And he reminded me, or I reminded him, of that occasion, and I asked him whether he still had a driver's license, and he did not answer.
Oh, really? Oh.
Anyhow, but the more interesting part, I think, of the experience as a prosecutor, not only sort of the disillusionment with the criminal justice system at that time, was I got moved into corruption cases in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia, it was like a bit like shooting fish in a barrel, and municipal corruption.
Huh.
And that led to my being hired by Archibald Cox for the Watergate cases because I had some of that kind of experience. Did not fit into the type of activities that we found at Watergate, but it was close enough.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. You were in D.C. for that, right? You must have matriculated
yep.
to D.C. at
I did.
Some point.
Yeah.
Before that or right?
No, I was in Philadelphia. And I was conducting preliminary hearings in a prison when I got a call from the deputy special prosecutor, Hank Ruth, who had also been a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And I had read his name in the paper that he'd just
right.
become deputy special prosecutor. And I actually called him. And he said it was on a Friday afternoon. I called him from my kitchen phone, and he said, "Well, we're looking for, we need prosecutors, and we're hiring. When can you come down?" I said, "How about Monday?"
Oh, so this you were aware of it, and you said maybe I can help. Or something.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly. Great. So I volunteered myself to
yeah.
you know to go to Washington, and I took the train down. And on that Monday afternoon, I interviewed with Archibald Cox, and Henry Ruth and a couple of his senior associates, and I got hired.
But so then you moved to D.C.?
Absolutely. Tore up a newly signed apartment lease and tried to figure out what to do.
Were you married at that point?
Yeah, and my wife and I both gave up our...
No kids yet?
Current jobs, no kids. No kids.
So no kids, you and your wife moved to D.C. to sort
right.
of a brand
so
new start.
Decision made over, over the weekend, and then moved probably 10 days later.
And that's not, I mean, you moved into D.C. and right into the most...
parachuted right into the largest
in the
political
middle of it, yeah.
scandal crisis of that of the 20th century, I think.
Still one of the largest. I mean...
I think it is.
So I wanted to ask you about that, too. Let's talk, we can talk about how you, what you did for the prosecution or what you found out, but... You know, people look back and sort of think that that was like a low point of American politics. And I often wondered if that's the case or is this just the one time that it sort of got caught and both sides do these sorts of political spying?
I actually think it was a low point, and not just because I participated and was there, but because we have tapes.
Yeah.
I think what distinguishes Watergate from... previous and some later activity, all the Gates,
right.
that had been, mini micro scandals, everything's named Gate.
Right.
So that was sort of the granddaddy of them all. One of the things that distinguished it was thousands of hours of White House tape recordings, which really disclosed the nature of Nixon's presidency, the kind of meanness.
It was mean, right?
Of
yeah.
it. Yeah. The bias, the bigotry, the revenge, the getting even part. That's still there. That's going to be there in the National Archives, and that won't go away. And that, aside from the actual, the meanness and the intention led into acts of criminality. I mean, a burglary team
right.
resident in the White House,
yeah.
for one, wiretaps and...
So let's talk about this. You're hired. You
yeah.
move to D.C. You don't really have any idea what you're going to find yet, and you start unearthing these examples.
I was 28 years old, 28, 29.
Uh-huh.
And what happened my first day, it was July 16th, 1973. I was signing in the federal papers and all that bureaucratic stuff, and I looked up, and there was this little grainy black and white television that was televising the Senate Watergate hearings. And it was that day that a White House employee named Alexander Butterfield disclosed that there was a White House taping system.
Hmm.
And so everything changed from an evidentiary point of view. We're not going to just have to rely on the testimony of then John Dean, the president's counsel. There are tapes. And so the afternoon of my first day, I was called into Archibald Cox's office, along with a couple other people, including Stephen Breyer, who now sits on the Supreme Court.
Uh-huh.
Actually, overall, much more distinguished crew than I, for sure. And discussed whether to subpoena the tapes, which, as a young prosecutor, I thought was a foregone conclusion.
Right.
But Cox took us through the fact that at the end of a series of cases in the federal courts, which we expected to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court and hope to win, but even if we won unanimously, what if Nixon refused to turn over the tapes? We just created a constitutional crisis that was
right.
Unprecedented. And none of us knew the answer of what to do. And he called us back about 3 hours later and told us he just wanted us to think about it. But, of course, we were going to subpoena the tapes.
Right.
And at the end of that, we did win the Supreme Court case. And I happened to be sitting in Cox had been fired during the Saturday Night Massacre, so-called.
Uh-huh.
And I was sitting across from Leon Jaworski, the next special prosecutor, when Alexander Haig, the president's chief of staff, called Jaworski and said the tapes were ready to be picked up. So I volunteered to do that. It was Saturday morning, and I was wearing my then fashionable bell bottoms. I look like somebody off the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band
right, yeah.
album.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to walk the 4 or 5 blocks of the White House and walked through the line of tourists waiting to get in and for their weekend experience.
Uh-huh.
And went into the counsel's office. Fred Bizarre was then the president's counsel. And he had a cardboard box with 9 tapes and handed it over to me. And I said,
you walked away.
Well, I said, shouldn't we have a receipt for this? And he said, he was sort of absent-minded. I mean, I think he knew that the game was up.
Uh-huh.
He'd obviously listened to what was on the tapes.
And, yep.
So we drew up handwritten receipts, countersigned them, signed them, countersigned them, handed them over, and I just walk out through this crowd of Saturday tourists with a box.
That's amazing.
And so, I walked back to the office, and my colleagues, a few of them knew that I was on this kind of mission, and sat down, and we put on headsets, and I asked one of my colleagues which tape, you know, should we listen to first, and he said, you know, I think it was December 21, 1972. John Dean says a meeting with the president. There's a cancer on the presidency. So we, you know, put on the headsets, and sure enough, 7 minutes into the tape, there it is, and there is the president, President Nixon, saying that he could pay off, he could get the money to pay off the burglars, the hush money. And we knew at that point that his presidency was going to be over.
Right.
But, you know, we were subject to all kinds of rules of secrecy, grand jury secrecy.
I mean, what did you think when you found that? You didn't look very long, and here's a damning piece of evidence.
Well, one of my colleagues looked out the window. He'd been in Chile recently and said, where are the tanks? He could not believe that the president had just handed over the instruments of his own undoing.
Right, yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it was a remarkable moment for sure.
Yeah, I would say probably the most memorable moment of your life thus far. It would have to be.
One of them, certainly.
Good. What are the others? My God.
Well, some of what always go untold, but.
Okay, good. All right. But it almost boggles the mind to look back and think that these tapes, which are sort of like the linchpin of democracy of the moment, and you're just carrying them in a box down the street. I mean, today they'd send armored cars and 10 people.
Where's the media?
Exactly.
Following me, or where were where were the representatives of foreign intelligence agencies?
Yeah.
Right? And I'm just blithely, you know, I'm just going through town and
carrying a box,
cardboard box. You know, I thought the people in line at the White House must have thought I was a kind of a plumber,
yeah,
with a spare part for one of the toilets.
They're cleaning out the trash cans from upstairs or something.
But interestingly, getting more to the scientific side of Watergate, I was one of the only prosecutors who had science background. So when there was an 18.5-minute gap in a White House tape, which is one of the tapes, there was a key tape. It was the first meeting that the President Nixon had after the break-in with one of his aides, H.R. Haldeman. There was this strange, mysterious gap in a key part of the conversation.
So 18 minutes of silence.
Buzz.
There was
a buzz, yeah. And we decided that we had to look into that. And I was selected to supervise the investigation of the 18.5-minute gap and put together a team of scientists who knew new stuff. I mean, and knew about tape recorders,
audio technology,
every aspect of audio technology at the time. You know, folks from MIT and Harvard and Stanford, University of Utah. There was a guy named Tom Stockham. So people had all, you know, various types of expertise, and they eventually came up with a report that indicated that it was an intentional erasure of the tape made by this particular recorder that the president and his secretary, Rosemary Woods, had.
So did we ever find out what those 18 minutes were?
Never.
Wow.
And apparently to this day, the technology does not allow us to recover that.
But so they're in some room and they go, well, Carl, you studied biology. You get a team together to go.
I said, you know, you need, you know, physicists and you know, electronic engineers here.
Yeah.
And I said, well,
you take care
we don't have that. You know, you figure it out.
Okay. So what happens? So Nixon's out of the White House. What happens? Or what happens to you next?
Well, I I had among my responsibilities at Watergate was also to look into allegations that the intelligence community had been involved in certain Watergate offenses. In fact, the CIA had given disguises, helped the original Watergate burglars with some disguises and previous break-in, et cetera. But then there were deeper theories that Richard Helms, who was director of the CIA, had a vendetta against Nixon, and it was sort of a CIA coup of the presidency and the president, which was not the case, to be clear. And I was sort of in that one. I was not I was not just chosen. I volunteered for that one. That seemed fascinating. So I got into I got all these clearances, and I got into national security affairs through that sort of back door. And then later, not much later, but I got hired to be Inspector General for Intelligence again at the White House.
At the Pentagon. That's right.
To prevent the kinds of abuses that we are again seeing.
Yeah, you're at the Pentagon. What are you doing, and how long did this go on?
That went on for 4 years, and I remained fascinated with national security affairs and started my own company. This is my startup experience, a company named Palomar Corporation.
Oh, yeah.
Which was hired to do national security studies. Then it was the U.S.-Soviet Union. I did studies of basically related to arms control negotiations, the SALT negotiations, SALT 1 and 2 negotiations that were going on to allow what would allow us to verify, you know, the agreements and what would not. So, again, it was sort of using biology background, forgive me, you know, but to get into some of the more technical aspects and to bridge the pretty wide gap between negotiators who are, you know, political scientists and you know, cold warriors with some with the science and vice versa, you know, indicate to the scientists what the, what really the clear needs were of the of negotiators, what they needed to know.
This is I'm guessing here, but this is where the book Looking the Tiger in the Eye came from.
That's right. Right. In the 80s, there were lots of demonstrations, nuclear disarmament, et cetera, and, you know, the basic Cold War fear that we just blow ourselves up. And I decided to take on the try to write a book for young people. My own children were not quite teenagers at the time, but getting there.
Yeah.
And were asking questions about the bomb. And so...
Yeah, because, you know, we were having things like... you know, bomb drills at school, you know, just in case some sort of
crawl
nuclear...
under your desk.
That's right,
Right? Put your head between your legs and whistle Dixie.
Right, as the radiation waves come through the school.
So, yeah, so I took some time, and that was... I'm glad I did it. I wrote it with a co-author. It did pretty well for a while.
Yeah, New York Times Book of the Year.
Yeah,
one of the books of the year.
It was one of the books of the year. It won... a Christopher Medal, which was very nice, and then book sales plummeted when the Soviets folded on me.
Really, they
ruined
it.
When the wall came down, that was the end of. People thought the nuclear threat was over, which of course not.
Yeah. Okay. So that brings us. I mean, we're getting close to the formation of BIO, right?
Yeah, we are. We got one more step.
What's the step?
And that was I was playing squash with Arlen Specter, which was our habit. Throughout the years, he had become senator in 1980, and while I was at the Pentagon, and I was you know at Palomar, and one time during I was about to sell Palomar, and which I did, he asked me whether I would consider coming on as chief of staff in the Senate. So I said, you know, I'd never even been a staff member in the Senate, much less chief of staff. But he and I knew each other very well,
right?
And I agreed, not knowing really what to do after the book got published, and that was a big effort, and then merging Palomar, actually really did not know what to do next, and I agreed to come on as chief of staff, which was a wonderful catbird seat, a perch, to do all kinds of both international and domestic, get involved in international domestic issues. He was on the Appropriations Committee, on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and so I took a pretty active chief of staff role in, you know, in that range of issues.
And this sort of allows you, I'm assuming, to you got a good view of how Washington works, and the ins and outs of what you need to do to get things done.
For sure.
And I think that would be really helpful for you later, as when
BIO. It was critical. Not necessarily the part that people would imagine. Of how the Senate itself works, but really, I worked with Specter for 4 years as chief of staff, and we had some amazing adventures with him. I mean, spending 2 hours with Saddam Hussein, for example, in Baghdad, and that's a little off the subject. But
no, that's way interesting, though. So
in al-Assad, in Bashir, not Bashir, Hafez, his father, in Damascus, events like that occurred, as well as the day-to-day life of the Senate and all the issues, many of which we're still wrestling with, gun control, for example, terrorism.
It's funny how these things that were, it seemed like on the tip of change 20, 30 years ago, are still not changed.
That's right.
I guess that probably also says something about, well, not Washington, or maybe Washington.
No, I'd say it's something about human nature. I mean, people don't read history, don't learn from history.
We're pretty dug in.
I mean, every new administration comes in to the White House and throws out everything that reminds them of the old administration, including what might have been really useful.
Yeah.
So that happened.
So just briefly, because it is interesting, the Saddam Hussein meeting, what was that like? I mean, just from an observer's point of view, that'd have to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're asleep, the delegation. It was just Specter and one other senator and myself. And we were sleeping at the Al-Rashid Hotel about 2 in the morning. This knock on the door that Saddam will see us now and wake up, put on our clothes, jump into his black Mercedes turbos and speed across downtown Baghdad in the middle of the night and really speed. And then at a certain point, just screech to a halt, turn around, said, Saddam, busy, not going to see you now. We go back get back in bed.
I mean, that just must be power trip stuff.
Yeah, psychological warfare.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, again, of course, like an hour and a half later, knock on the door, see you now. And we jump back in the cars, and this time we go to this palace that lit up, kind of ice blue, eerie, has tank traps and a moat. So it is medieval, really medieval, actually. And there's a little backstory. I mean, part of our routine at any of these foreign visits, I would carry Specter's. He'd hand me his little brownie camera. And at some point during the meeting, I would stand up and take pictures for us. And we'd hang on the wall in the office, et cetera. And I had the camera. And as I went into Saddam's palace, one of his guards kind of roughly grabbed me by the wrist and tore the camera out of my hand, and then went on to a waiting room, and waiting in there, and Specter notices, where's my camera? And I said, the guard took it. He said, in typical Specter fashion, I didn't give you permission to give away my camera. I said, we're in Baghdad, and I'll buy you a better camera when we get back to Philadelphia.
Right.
And he was having none of it, and it was his property. And he had a point to make, and Saddam wasn't going to take anything from him. And so he made me I argued with the guard, then argued with the guard supervisor, then his supervisor, and pretty much got nowhere. And then we're waiting for about 45 minutes, and all of a sudden this wall opens up and reveals Saddam walking down this blind corridor, backlit by his own TV crew, and he's carrying the camera in his hand. And he turns to Specter and says, here's your camera. Take my picture. And Specter refuses to do so.
Are you serious? That's a great story. That's just maybe a few words about Specter because, his personas, he's beloved and tenacious, and that story sort of suggests both of
a very
things.
Hard case. I mean, he's a dear friend of mine and a mentor, a great mentor and a great friend. But, grew up, his father was a junk dealer in Russell, Kansas, and youngest kid, he was sent out to cut down with an oxyacetylene torch, oil derricks in the field that had blown down from tornadoes.
For the metal, right?
For the scrap. And it was very tough. And then, got to go to University of Pennsylvania and then Yale Law School. A very brilliant guy. Very difficult human being, tough, very tough, very exacting on his staff, which was a great learning experience, of course, if you could take it.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he held himself to the same or higher standards. So it wasn't unfair.
Yeah.
It was just difficult.
Okay. So now?
So I'm in Specter's office, actually, and had some,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The great experiences moving out in Baghdad and Damascus and also all through Pennsylvania. And it was time for me to leave. He won re-election in 1992. Uh-huh. And I had, again, no idea what to do professionally. My kids were now in private school. My wife was about to go back to work and just had to pay the bills. And so I actually noticed someone brought to my attention a journal of CEO positions that were open. I had never known of the journal, and there was on the, you know, the head of the Des Moines Public Library System, not for me, and then something bio, some biotechnology industry organization, looking for president, CEO, and it read like the combination of science and politics, Washington. I said,
yeah, that's perfect.
That's exactly right. So I immediately picked up the phone and I called the executive search person and said, you know, look, I just noticed that ad, and here's my quick background. And I kept talking. He said, hold it, wait. This has been on the street now for 8 weeks, and we have 6 finalists, and this search is over. So we're going to meet with them. The CEOs on the search committee are going to meet with them tomorrow, so forget about it. This one's over. And I just couldn't believe that opportunity had passed.
Right.
I said, can I fax you my – in those days, can I fax you my resume? He said, you can fax me anything you want. You know, this is over. So I faxed him my resume. And the next night I was at home really upset that this one – I missed this one. And the guy calls and said the search committee didn't like any of the 6 candidates and wanted a new panel, and I was on it. And so I immediately started reading the Office of Technology Assessments – 1,400-page opus on biotechnology.
You had the basic skills, right? Because of the
political skills and some science background.
Yeah, the basic science that could pull you through, but you needed to get up to speed on.
Absolutely, and there are 2 things. One, I was not up to speed, certainly up to speed on the science, and secondly, I knew not a single person in the industry.
Yeah,
not one.
Yeah,
not one. So to make a 3-month story very short, I went through a series of interviews, etc. And very fortunately, got hired. Now, that was the best job I ever had.
Really? That's great. I didn't know. So who founded Bio then?
We did.
Well, I mean, something was in place.
I mean, there was a group of CEOs from 2 prior forerunner trade associations that had been fighting for years.
Between the two of them.
The two of them had been rivals.
Back and forth, yeah.
Instead of coming together with one voice, there was a rivalry. And it was really it was not helpful, to say the least.
No.
To the industry's interest.
They knew that they wanted to form sort of a dual thing, and we're not looking for the CEO. Once you're on board, then you sort of put it in place.
Well, they didn't exactly tell me that was going to happen. It led me to believe it was already done. Once I got hired, I realized that it was not done, and that there were still big divisions among the staffs, didn't like each other.
Really?
And, I mean, it was. It's not untypical of
mergers.
Right. but it was all there. It was really all there. And essentially I gave both staffs about a week to cross the bridge, either your bio
or you're now.
Yeah. You're gone. And some of them stayed and, you know, some of them couldn't. And we started from there with about, I guess, 7 or 8 employees.
And how many companies were represented
there?
Yeah,
probably, 80 or 90.
Oh, that many?
Yeah, but very small companies, almost no revenues.
Yep.
And no name recognition. I mean, no recognition at all. Members of Congress didn't know what it was, mm-hmm. couldn't spell it.
Mm-hmm.
The media was mysterious. And so we really, with a very able group of folks, some of whom had been in the previous trade associations and a majority of whom hired later, really felt like it was a startup and starting from scratch.
It's fun.
And I like that.
Yeah.
And I also had great support from the CEOs who were sick and tired of the division. That, one organization would go up to Congress and say potato, the other could say potato,
uh-huh.
and nothing would happen. Congress, they just couldn't make up their minds who to believe, and just zero got done. So we had to end that. But we had nothing in terms of resources, although there were a whole lot of, a lot of little companies. The largest, of course, were Genentech and Amgen at mm-hmm. the time, I believe.
Yeah.
No big pharma companies, but set out, and getting back to what I learned from the Spector experience, every 2 years, Arlen would visit all 67 of Pennsylvania's counties, right? Every one of them.
And
right?
Go, you do a stump speech there or just stop
he
in?
He would go to the Elks or the Hibernians or Ancient Order of Moose or whatever it was, and also to the local newspaper when there were local newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And he would give a couple of speeches. He'd meet with the county chairs, whether they were Republican or Democrat, and he would give interviews to the local reporters or editors or usually one and the same person.
Yeah.
And so I learned from that. And what I did the first couple of years at Bio was to fly to San Francisco, rent a car, and just drive up and down 101 through mm-hmm. Silicon Valley, down, from the city to Mountain View, out to Berkeley. And I would visit as many companies as I could and actually see their labs, meet their CEOs, meet their people, learn what they were doing, collect stories to tell of what the industry was actually doing from on the ground.
And would you ask them, what are your hurdles? What do you need from Washington in order to populate this industry, how to get over...
Exactly. Yeah. Some of them had IP, intellectual property issues. Some had technical FDA issues or the whole range of stuff. And they needed help. And, I was benefiting greatly from very low expectations, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Many of these CEOs hadn't been to Washington since their 8th grade class visiting.
Yeah.
So the level of experience there and also expectations were very low. And I gave interviews to local media and both trade press and the big newspapers were interested. Like, what is this? We've heard about it. And what's it about? And I would call ahead of time, like a local radio station that had a call-in show, and I would offer to do a call-in show on biotechnology. And typically, the response was, well, if you tell me what it is,
we'll consider it. Yeah.
We'll do it. And they virtually always said yes. And in terms of getting a message out, I could do that in a station in Akron, Ohio, there were 6,000 people at rush hour sitting in their cars listening to radio, and I could reach them. So it didn't cost anything.
Yep. Yep.
So there were a number of interesting, shall we say, innovative ways you could do this, but I took these caravans, just one car, all through California, and I would rent a car in Washington D.C. or take my own car and drive up through Baltimore, through Philadelphia, all the way through through New Jersey,
uh-huh.
and New York, and up Connecticut,
up to Cambridge,
and along the way it would take a week or 10 days. and along the way meet with as many companies as I could, as many newspapers, journals, biweekly, whatever they were, and I would try to convince the CEOs to join Bio. And it was just on the ground politicking, getting to know what their companies were, collecting, again, good stories
right.
On the ground. And that was a real basis, on the ground basis. You know, at about 5,000 or 10,000 foot altitude, we still had no political presence in Washington. Very, very few members of Congress have any science background still.
Yep.
Level of ignorance and rumor and prevalence of rumor, et cetera, is just they'd
unaware.
Heard, they'd read about killing of monarch butterflies or,
yep.
You know, cloning. Of course, you know, we hit some really big crises, you know, with Dolly and
right.
cloning. So, and those I took as opportunities to explain what we did and what we didn't do. One of the advantages that I did have, which I'll tell you is sort of an inside baseball story, is during Watergate, I met a number of up-and-coming reporters who sort of made their bones during Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was at Bio, they were now editors, in some cases managing editors,
uh-huh.
of newspapers. So I had a little bit of a leg up, one clear chance. I would ask them, many of them my friends, I said, who's covering biotech for you? Or if I'm already new, just said, can you make an introduction? And they would say, you know, they'd give me one clear chance with a reporter. You know, my editor says you were a good guy
yeah.
during Watergate.
Yeah.
And so I'd get a chance to establish a relationship with them, and I took every one of those chances. But almost every afternoon, I would go home about 4 o'clock, miss the traffic in Washington, sit at my dining room table and just take calls. Just take calls. As the reporters and editors were finishing their stories, I would just take calls and answer their stuff. And, you know, on the record, on background, mm-hmm. or off the record.
Yep.
And, you know, frankly, I only got screwed twice in 12 years.
In bad ways? In major ways?
No.
No. But you just remember that it was...
Don't forget. I mean, ways that made me very angry.
Do you want to talk about those? You don't need to name the publication. Do you want to talk about those?
Oh, I think it's amazing. I only got
the twice, yeah.
Only twice.
But what were they? You mentioned something proprietary or...
No. Words manipulated and questions manipulated without telling me the story.
I see. Okay.
Using quotes so out of context and that it reversed my meaning, those types of things.
Yeah. That would irritate me.
I think
beyond belief.
But
yeah.
The fact that happens so infrequently, it was just a few
good
occasions.
Sign, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you must have done thousands and thousands.
I did many, uncountable. And people, you know, treated like professionals, they were.
Yeah.
And we had a part of American democracy, and we had a good relationship, and it worked mutually beneficial.
So I looked this up on Open Secrets. The earliest recording of BioGiving, I think, was 1998, and it was maybe 1.7 million or something, and it went to 8.6 in 2010, and it's come down since then. But it's a big jump. You know, as the industry has grown, do you think that was something that they needed to do to help sort of establish their voice in D.C.?
Inevitable. It was inevitable. I mean, eventually, we got big enough. That we grew, we were growing in the 90s at 20-30% a year.
Wow!
In terms of both staff and revenues, and in a couple of years we may have hit 40%. People were joining, new companies were being established, and they trusted us and some in to do their politics, and to do some of their communications
mm-hmm.
that were awkward for them to handle. That were issues bigger than their individual company. And also Bio, we started not just doing their politics and their communications, but we started business meetings.
The partnering meetings.
Yeah,
yeah.
The Bio, and we grew the main Bio meeting, mm-hmm. as we talked earlier, up to about 20,000, 22,000.
It's a big, I mean, you can only hold that meeting in certain cities then.
Oh,
you have to have a space
large
enough.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And for those of us on the staff, it was like an out-of-body experience for 5 days. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And and fun in some ways, but I used to tell people to take 15 days off afterwards.
Tiring, yeah.
Yeah, you can't. You don't think you're not normal right now, so yeah. take your time off. But we built those franchises, and so whatever the reasons for joining, and some companies were not so interested in the politics, and maybe they had competent people doing their communications, wanted to keep it that way, but they were interested in rubbing elbows with some of the bigger companies or having meeting opportunities that they otherwise would not have.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, because this is, from the outside, I'm not sure really what happens with campaign contributions or just lobbying money in general. I mean, what does BIO do with the money? Does it go to educate, politicians on what biotech is? That means travel. That means, I don't know.
What happens generally is that you have a fundraiser, an event, typically. And so it could be a breakfast. We're here in New York right now.
Uh-huh.
I remember breakfast we had with Charlie Rangel,
uh-huh.
right? And what you do is you raise money, and then you go to some hotel, and you have a breakfast, and you have the CEOs or the representatives from that area, from New York, for example, or wherever area, explain what you have three of them or five of them, explain what the companies do and their companies do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would give a little overview of what the industry is all about, et cetera. And we really, Representative Rangel, you're Chairman Rangel, you're on this committee or that committee, and we have these intellectual property issues, and here's our perspective, and we could use we really would like your support. And, you end up, forking over 5,000, 10,000, 20,000. We were small. I mean, the big organizations, these would be big. Contribution.
But that's the thing. So the money is actually, you don't slide a briefcase across the table.
No.
To Rangel. No, I mean,
where
does the money?
You have to write a publicly acknowledged check from the PAC,
uh-huh.
To the campaign.
I see. So it's all campaign contributions.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So
Well, of course, I mean, of course, I'm a former prosecutor.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, of course.
Other things happen. We didn't do that.
Right. So that sort of briefcase thing probably still exists for sure out there. But most.
The briefcase thing has existed since 4000 BC,
Since the first briefcase, these things
existed. Since the first briefcase.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's as BIO's membership has grown and its importance has grown, and quite frankly, when you stepped away and Greenwood came in, they became an even more powerful lobbying force. That was the first thing that everybody noticed
right.
from the outside. It became sort of, when you were there, it was sort of like a, almost like a family shop that everyone knew. And then it was like, we are now an official lobbying group in D.C. I think to BIO's benefit. I mean, to the community's benefit. Yeah.
I do too.
So let's talk about it. I think I read someplace that you said when BIO was formed, you needed to establish a voice for the industry, which I think you did quite well. What is BIO still doing today? Is that still their main goal? Is it to educate?
Yeah, I think they have a stat. I think they have a voice. They really do. And Jim Greenwood is someone I knew, of course, very well when he was in Congress.
Yeah.
And one of my first trips by car around in the north, I got caught in a snowstorm in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, and I spent a couple hours. He was stuck too in his district office,
mm-hmm.
and we put our feet up and spent a couple hours together, I think, in the first year of BIO. And then much later, after I'd announced that I was going to retire, he called and said, "Would you think I should be interested in this?" And I said, "You sure should."
Yeah.
And recognizing the evolution, I mean, I love startups. I love the startup atmosphere. I love knowing every person on the staff. And I could sort of do that up to about 50 people.
Yeah.
And that's what I enjoy the most. And once it got to the point where we just had to grow in terms of staff, in terms of reach, in terms of political contribution and clout, but you're up against other major lobbies.
Right.
So you have to compare your clout, no matter, if we can give eight times more than we did in my day, you still have lobbies and now you have super PACs
right.
out there. That just drown them in money. Very unfortunate for the country, actually. There's a preeminent footnote here. Supreme Court decisions that corporations are people.
Yeah.
And free speech, you can give as much money. This is it's not one person, one vote anymore. It's one 1 million or 1 billion one vote.
Right. So what? So
bad.
So we can talk about. Okay. It's actually interesting to talk about the political environment these days, right? Contentious. I don't know. I mean, everyone says it's more contentious now than it's ever been. I don't know that that's the case.
You know what? That is the case. I'm venturing a real opinion here.
Let's have it. So and why is that the case?
Well, it's complex. It's some complex reasons that I think once we hear them, we all know. I mean, 24-hour news cycle, the politicization, the media. Now we're more like some European media where the newspaper was a social democrat paper,
uh-huh.
right, or a conservative uh-huh. paper. And now our media is lined up. They're really political parties,
right?
Essentially. And, you know, they drive polarization in the extremes. You know, we've been through this. I know as much about it as everybody.
Right.
But it really is unfortunate. I mean, when I was inspector's office, we worked with anybody, everybody. He was a moderate Republican, a now extinct
yep.
species. And I was registered independent when I was president of Bio. And people, you know, couldn't figure out which side. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
And we would negotiate and get the support of no matter what party you were or what state you were in.
Yeah, Jim being a moderate Republican too, or he was.
That's
when
correct.
He was actually, so that he was another great person to take over the helm there.
Yeah.
And so what do you think that Bio needs to do, if you have an opinion on this, I don't know, going forward? What is their main goal now?
I live in Idaho, and when I left Washington, I'd spent 31 years in Washington. I like to say I got paroled,
uh-huh.
and now I'm out in the country,
mm-hmm.
and I'm still, as we can go into, I'm still active as director on boards, all biotech. All my activities are, professional activities are biotech.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left, I decided, you know, we're cutting it. I don't go to bio meetings.
Yeah.
You know, I'm out of there. Jim Greenwood's running the place,
right?
And I'm happy not to be in the particular political environment that he's now having to swim in, right? That pool. So I'm not an expert on where they are exactly, where they are on every issue or such, but I think the industry needs to maintain just a distinct identity and make it clear, just as we. And this is harder to do because of the blending of big pharma
yeah, exactly.
with biotech.
Yeah.
And now the lines are indistinguishable. Okay? It was easier, I must say, easier when we started Bio
mm-hmm.
to draw that distinction. And I know it upset the pharma people until they decide to join.
What, you mean it upset them to have this division between small biotechs and
yeah,
big pharma?
Yeah, you know, some big pharma execs said, they're making he was complaining about something I had said. You know, these biotech people are creating miracle drugs, and, and we're doing chewing gum and aspirin.
Right, we're selling Band-Aids. Yeah.
So, okay. But you know, distinct insofar as to let the vigor and the particular culture of the small companies and the startups, that's the identity that continuously needs to be captured and recaptured. And, you know, bigger companies are going to want to drive the bus.
Yeah.
That's natural, normal. But, you know, they have pharma. And, you know, I just think maintaining a powerful core identity of young, not necessarily only young, but young, small, it's a cultural.
Right. So keeping that culture of a young, sort of scrappy startup, doesn't yeah. have a lot of money, virtual these days sometimes, as yeah. opposed to we're huge drug development companies.
That's hard to
goal.
Do. Yeah. It's very hard to maintain it. Over time, you got to grow up.
Yeah.
So, you go from, I think I left. When I left, I would characterize as a young adult or almost maybe adolescent, still adolescent or maybe young adult stage organization. But now you're grown up.
You're on some boards now, Life Science Foundation.
Yeah.
How long after your parole from Bio did you join Life Science Foundation?
Well, it was about it didn't get formed until about 4 or 5 years after I retired.
Uh-huh.
So I joined when it got organized. And I believe just like in the beginning of Bio, when the people who worked in the industry didn't know it was an industry, didn't know that they were distinct.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, there was a question whether we're really like junior pharma or whether we have a distinct identity at all. And they now know that they do. And now, 20 years later, it's important to capture the histories of the pioneers of the industry.
Right.
For various, you know, any obvious reasons, health, death, memory, and capturing their oral video histories, documenting them. And that is the basic research, scholarly effort by the Life Sciences Foundation. And once captured and transcribed and processed and archived and all those things that responsible organizations need to do with significant materials, to repurpose them for education, everything from, you know, blogs, social media, scholarly articles, quotes on issues as they arise. And that's essentially the mission and what is happening at Life Sciences Foundation.
It's grant-funded?
No, it's funded by individuals and corporations who are, you know, some of the pioneer organizations. And we're now into the next generation of pioneers.
Yeah.
You know, and as historians, some historians have told me, one historian in particular, said that, you know, 300 years from now, the last 30 years in biotechnology, in biology and the science will be like the Renaissance. The last 30 years, these 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the impact it's going to have on the rest of the 21st century and beyond.
Huge.
Yeah, huge impact. And so I believe that historian. You know, one of the many interesting things about the biotech village, the group, is their willingness to tell stories on themselves, the highs and the lows, you know, the clinical failures just getting flattened, you know, in the science.
Yeah.
Nature just is not working for us. And then the markets kick in and roll you over again. But their willingness to tell those stories are instructive, both from an operational point of view, from new CEOs' mistakes. And I'm seeing the recycling of the same old mistakes. One of the things I can do as a board member is say, you know, I recognize the direction you're headed. That's mistake 47D, which I made.
Yeah.
And here's where
I've
it
seen
leads.
This. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean, do you have any of those like favorite stories from early biotech? I mean, one of mine, it's not, it might even be a rumor, I don't know, but when Amgen was first formed, it was formed in Thousand Oaks because it was at the time, there was really nothing built up around it. And if they had some sort of blow up in the lab or some sort of breach, it would blow out to sea instead of into homes. Is that actually true?
I don't know.
Yeah, I love that story.
Yeah.
That the science was so unknown. They thought, well, whatever we're doing, we want it to go out to sea.
Yeah, you know, you want some really fun, weird stories.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell them to you right now.
Good.
But what to do is take a look at the business plans of some of the early companies. They are embarrassingly amusing.
In what ways? You mean?
We're going to use plant X to, you know, produce this in oncology and then use, I mean, just
things that we now know are not at all possible.
Quite ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they're part of an actual business plan and they're written down and they're hidden someplace because the CEO reread them at some point and said, bury this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, and the kinds of things that they'll do is at a bio meeting, and you won't see this. In my years with Spectre, et cetera, didn't see this with other industries, where the CEOs will get up and there'll be three of them on stage or five, and they'll say, how I screwed up my last company. And then one of them will say, no, I did this wrong, that wrong, this wrong. I said, no, I can beat that.
Yeah.
Here's what I did. And it's so instructive for the audience, but it's also just such a great sense of openness and relief.
I mean,
just be able to tell those stories on yourself.
I want to ask you, so how did you end up in Idaho?
You know, grew up in Philadelphia and family always went to the shore, the Jersey Shore, when I was growing up, and I hate the beach. And so when I became an adult and my nuclear family, deciding where to go on summer vacations, let's get as far away from the beach as we could.
Into a landlocked state.
So, yeah, we go to Idaho, the Sawtooth Mountains, the Northern Rockies, and vacation there, as inconvenient as that was, you know, like 20, 200 miles away.
Yeah.
And started a tradition of about 25 years of summer vacations out there. And then when decided to leave bio and leave Washington after 31 years, as I said, to actually move out there and experience small town life.
But the winters have to be
brutal.
Yeah.
And long.
How do you handle that?
I travel a lot, actually.
That helps.
And the first couple of months of winter are just fine, crisp and clear. And I snowshoe, and it's a very athletic, healthy place.
Yeah.
Love it for that. And relative low stress and no complaint zone. People are very happy to be out there in the mountains. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
And so it's a healthy place. And now my children, my grown children, my son and his family live in Geneva, Switzerland. My daughter and her family live in Berkeley, California. So I'm split any which way. So I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling.
So the two kids, does either one work in biotech?
My son is a global health guy who was director of global health for the National Security Council in Washington until a few months ago, and is now head of strategy and policy for the Global Fund in Geneva for malaria, HIV, and TB. But it's it's a healthy place. The winters are long. By the time you get to April and May, you really do want to be somewhere else. But, I spent 30 years in Philadelphia, 31 years in Washington, and now small-town life is actually quite appealing.
Yeah. We've talked about what bio has done well, and we talked about mistakes. What were there any big mistakes, maybe bio under your leadership took the wrong direction, or you wish that you could have, done it differently than you did?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah, I mean, on a very personal basis, it was in Washington, even though it was more congenial than the Washington of today, it was still just a very demanding 24/7 hard plow, push. And what I came to regret was every time, I didn't do it frequently, but I regret every single time I lost my temper. It just never went better.
You mean
it made things worse?
You'd be in a meeting, you'd be having some conversation, and they would.
I don't lose my temper very often. But looking back, if I were to see 7 or 8 times when I just really got outraged or enraged, it just didn't make things better.
Yeah, you look back and think that
was a mistake.
That was a mistake.
Yeah. Every time whenever I did that, and I never did it publicly, but it just didn't work with staff, or there was one White House meeting that was supposed to be confidential, and a couple of occasions like that, where someone would press an employee wanted me to hire somebody, and it was just an outrageous demand. Or to take a favoritism with one company, and I just, for one or number of reasons, just lost it, and that was just never a good idea. It seemed that in some cases it won the day, but it lost the week and the month and the year.
Yeah, oh, interesting. That's good. So if that's your main complaint, though, that's a pretty good run.
It was a pretty good run. I did a little private memoir recently for my kids and grandkids. I called it Lucky Man. I feel lucky.
Listen, I appreciate you coming in. Appreciate the talk. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brady.
Oh, man, wasn't that interesting? Just even listening to this while I edit it, I found it interesting again, and I already knew the conversation. I was there the first time it happened. So thanks to Carl Fellbaum for coming in, and thanks for running bio for 12 years. You did a great job. You can find more of these podcasts on Stitcher, iTunes, and Nature Biotechnology's podcast homepage, including the full archives. I'd like to thank you for listening. Thanks to the Midwest Quiet for use of their music for this podcast. That is it for now. Until the next episode, you've been listening to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.